Running an online business is hard enough without the stress and time consumption of managing hosting. Whether managing one WordPress site or dozens, Kinsta's managed solutions offer speed, enterprise-grade security, and an intuitive dashboard. With 24/7, 365 human-only expert support, get peace of mind that your sites stay online, secure, and performing their best. Start today and get your first month free with migrations handled for you. Learn more at kinsta.com/podcast. That's kinsta.com/podcast.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Time of Monsters podcast. We're sponsored by The Nation magazine and available on all podcasting platforms. This week, we're taking up a nation that Americans don't often think about, but is now surprisingly in the news. And I see this as someone who's broadcasting from that nation, broadcasting from Canada, even though I usually talk about American politics. But the Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, is stepping down as leader of the Liberal Party, and there'll be a leadership contest and probably an election. And the perhaps not the final cause of all this, but a precipitating cause of Trudeau's resignation was Donald Trump threatening to make Canada the 51st state. And that has caused a kind of existential crisis within Canada, especially among the Canadian elite, which is kind of hyper-integrated within the United States, but now finds itself confronted with an American president that at least rhetorically wants to annihilate Canada. So to talk about all this, I'm very happy to have on past guest of the show, and a friend of the podcast, Nora Loretto, who is a Canadian journalist and a podcaster. She does the podcast Sandy and Nora Talk Politics, which is, I would say, the best Canadian podcast, although I'm not sure what the competition is like in that category. But
it's fierce. We're on top of a fierce category.
Yeah. But Nora, did you want to let's talk about what exactly just happened, because a lot happened, and it's very strange.
It is strange. Canadians aren't used to decisions like I'm resigning. Canadians are more used to I'm staying on until I don't know, die or get forced out. And Trudeau's kind of in that spot right now. He had to resign. That was a long time coming. And we started off the first kind of workday of 2025, if you're a white collar worker, with this resignation from our prime minister. It throws parliamentary work out the window. Everything stops. It probably will die because it stops until parliament comes back. And the first vote that is likely going to happen will be a confidence vote, which will then end all sessions of parliament, all committees of parliament, all business. And so we're in this kind of waiting period from now until March 24th. When there will likely be an election called. Now, that period of time is really important because the Liberal Party of Canada is in shambles, like a lot of its provincial counterparts are, and they need a leadership race. And so they're going to see who draws the shortest straw or the pickled egg or whatever it is that they do for their leadership races to see who's going to lead them to pretty much for sure lose the next election.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I mean, there's a couple of things there, one of which is that there has been, the Liberals have been in trouble for a long time. I mean, to judge by the polling since at least the summer of 2022, they've been trailing the Conservatives, increasingly trailing the Conservatives, now, you know, by, you know, 10 to 20 points. And there has been a longstanding push to get Trudeau out of there. But as you say, it's not a Canadian norm. And Trudeau was holding on to dear life. While one can sort of predict that the Liberals are not going to come out of well in the election, there might be a way in which Donald Trump has done the Liberal Party a favor, because one can imagine a scenario where, like, you know, they get a trouncing, but they still, you know, hold on to 60, 70, 80 seats. Whereas I think there were polls showing that, you know, like under Justin Trudeau, they were heading at 16% of the polls, which would have given them like 6 seats in parliament, which would have been like annihilated. They could have faced annihilation as a party.
Yeah, annihilation still on the table. They had faced annihilation when Justin Trudeau became the leader of the Liberal Party. He really gave them a shot in the arm. And, you know, going back to this question of where Donald Trump fits in all of this, I think it is really, really interesting whether this was manufactured by the party to give them an excuse to have a leadership race, or if this was all, it happened the way that they said it happened. But just before the holidays, there was a budget statement, a budget update that was supposed to be delivered by the finance minister. And it was announced that the finance minister, you know, there was a cabinet shuffle right before the budget update. It was announced, like, some pieces of the update were leaked on Friday. And by Monday morning, the finance minister resigned, which is like really, really strange in Canadian politics. It's kind of strange. I mean, perhaps it's strange other places as well. Canadians aren't that exceptional, but we are, you know, we think we are. And that the brouhaha was over whether or not it was a demotion for Justin Trudeau to try and change Chrystia Freeland, the Minister of Finance, out of that portfolio and into a portfolio that was going to only deal with the United States. So he was going to create a special position for her to be the chief negotiator with the United States. And that comes from the negotiations or the role that Chrystia Freeland played in the last negotiations of NAFTA, which of course were done with Donald Trump. And Freeland's an American whisperer. She's lived in the United States. She's worked for American media. And this was, she said that was a demotion from finance minister and she walked, and this was it's very disrespectful of her. And this is what, like, this is the moment that started everything in the current political crisis, which is kind of an interesting moment, actually, because we do need someone to figure out how to talk to the United States. That's pretty clear. Now, the question of if are they walking towards annihilation or not, this is also a really big question, because certainly if the election was held now, and that's how journalists in Canada talk, is if the election is being held as we speak, you know, they would be wiped out. They would hold on to maybe a couple of seats in different parts of the country. But the way the electoral system works in Canada, it is very hard to take polls and just supplant it directly onto the electoral map. And so certainly you don't want to be low in the polls, but if your support is concentrated around certain ridings, you can have lower support but still win you know, the ridings that you need to win to block a conservative majority. And so this is where we are right now, is what is going to happen in the next 3 months or 2.5 months with the Liberal leadership. Will they find someone that's exciting? And I mean, I would not bet money that they're capable of doing that. They've got a real lack of talent in that party right now. But it is possible that they'll come up with someone who is good enough to stop the machine of Pierre Poilievre, the conservative leadership, from getting a majority government. Because remember that Canada has 5 parties. And the 5 parties, I mean, you got 3 kind of traditional parties that, you know, Americans will understand. They're national parties. They're going to have candidates in all of the ridings and all of the electoral districts. And then you have a party called the Bloc Québécois. And the Bloc Québécois is in the polls on the in a very, very good contender to be the next official opposition in Canada. And that is, I mean, for a political junkie, for like me, for someone that lives in Quebec, that someone that, you know, finds all this exciting, I mean, I just love the idea. The Bloc Québécois is a sovereigntist party. They only exist to give the provincial government's perspective of Quebec into Ottawa, into the national discussion. And they don't really care about much more than that. It wouldn't be the first time that the Bloc Québécois was the official opposition. It wouldn't even be the first time they were the opposition when free trade was the big debate on the table. That was the last time that the Bloc was the official opposition. And the forces have to conspire such that all of the other parties are so weak that the Bloc is the one that picks up all of the votes. And that's important because Quebec is a vote-rich province, as we say in Canada. It's got the second highest number of votes of any province in the country. And the Bloc is not on the ascent. They are at the top of their game. They are standing to win a huge number of seats in the province of Quebec, which will make getting a majority government for Poilievre very difficult, and will also make it difficult for the Liberals to get the second highest number of seats and be that official opposition.
No. I mean, I think that's a very likely scenario. I mean, for American listeners who, might not follow Canadian politics closely, yes, the Bloc is a sovereigntist party, and it would be a very curious thing. I mean, it would be as if in the English Parliament, the Sinn Féin were the second, the official opposition. But having said that, it is also ideologically a social democratic party, but perhaps not quite progressive on all issues in the way that people in the English speaking world might be familiar with, but certainly a party of the center left, and theoretically could provide like a much, especially if the Conservatives were kept to a minority, would provide a much fiercer opposition to the Conservatives. But it will also create dilemmas for the other parties, because I don't think that they would be able to join up with the Bloc as a sovereigntist party, as a party committed to Quebec becoming a separate country. They could not form a coalition with the Bloc. And then traditionally in Canadian society, for English-speaking parties to try to head in that direction is like you're touching the third rail. So yeah, I think all sorts of interesting political dilemmas come out of it. I just want to revisit this issue of like who the Liberal leader could be. I mean, we had mentioned Freeland, and it's worth emphasizing that in her resignation, which was one of the precipitating causes of Trudeau resigning, she said one, she was being demoted and disrespected. And this has a certain resonance because, on the one hand, Trudeau has campaigned as a feminist and said we'll have parity within the cabinet, but also has a kind of history of quarreling with female cabinet ministers and, from their point of view, disrespecting them. But secondly, she also said in her letter that, like at this time, we need a unity government in Canada. We need to unify across ideological and political lines, and to work with all the provinces to come up with a united front against Trump to figure out how to respond to this threat of Trump. So one could theoretically say, wouldn't that be a kind of strong basis for Freeland, like to run as a Liberal leader to say, I was, the one that was going to handle the American file, but let me handle it as Prime Minister, and I will be the unifying figure that could unite Canada as we, enter into this period where you have an American president who's at the very least talking about a tariff war, and more commonly is talking about annexing Canada.
Yeah. Her saying that she was going to run in the next election for me was the big tell that she has the door open to leadership. Now, she's also a team player as well. So I'm sure that she's the kind of person that would be tapped on the shoulder and would go along with someone else. She hasn't announced that she's running yet. If sexism didn't exist in politics, she would be the most obvious successor to Justin Trudeau. And of course, she faces that sexist reality that, makes it difficult for women politicians to step out and say, I'm going to be the leader. But the other thing working against her favor is that she's incredibly irritating. Like, you cannot listen to her for more than 5 minutes without wanting to punch yourself in the face. It doesn't matter what she's saying. And I've seen her give speeches. I've seen, obviously I've seen her talk a lot since she's been elected for the first time. And it is physically impossible to listen to her. And I think that my visceral reaction is more likely the average visceral reaction to how she speaks in this country. She has this like way of speaking that is like so faux upper class that doesn't work. It's like you're not upper class in the same way that, certain rich Canadians can speak to average Canadians and we're like, oh, we're enamored by that. And maybe that's sexism, I don't know. But she's just so out of touch. So out of touch. I mean, her big plan, a big idea to families to save money was like her family was canceling their like Disney Plus subscription or something like this. And she talked about like witnessing a soup line, I think she called it, outside of her church as like being really sad or whatever. And people were like, what the hell are you talking about? Like, the poverty is everywhere, man. Like, you got to walk around. So she, like, it is impossible for her to be a successful leader, I think, of the Liberal Party. She's got too many things working against her.
Well, I mean, on that point, I think being out of touch, I mean, the Conservatives under Poilievre are running on the slogan, Canada's broken. And Freeland literally said, Canada has never been broken.
Never once broken.
Yeah. Which is, you know, to my mind, call to mind sort of Hillary Clinton's response to Make America Great Again, which is America has always been great.
Exactly.
And I think that these are the sort of slogans of liberal complacency, which are very much out of touch with the political moment, which really is a political moment of the 21st century, going back, you know, at least to the 2008 financial meltdown, mm-hmm. if not earlier, of anti-system politics.
That's
of people
right.
feeling that they're legitimately feeling, for good reason, that their country is broken, that they're, you know, like in Canada, very serious problems with housing, homelessness, the healthcare system, which, you know, had been a source of pride, has been breaking down. So to run someone who says Canada has never been broken, it seems like a terrible mistake, and in ways almost like, you know, I could almost see her losing more badly than Justin Trudeau
yes.
would have lost. I mean, because he at least, you know, he also comes from, you know, an elite background. I mean, his father was famously a prime minister, and his family has been wealthy for generations. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he does actually, Justin Trudeau at his peak does have a bit of the popular touch, which Freeland does not have.
No.
The other sort of contender, and I think there's signs that he's in this race seriously, is the former governor of the Bank of Canada and of the Bank of England.
Yeah.
A governor of two central banks, Mark Carney. Do you think at this moment of populist anti-system politics, running the someone whose main resume is being a central banker is a good move?
I think it's nuts, frankly. Like, I think that the idea that Mark Carney, like, he should be racking up central banks under his belt that he's managed instead.
I mean, in Germany, the German bank or the European bank, he should.
For sure. I mean, the sky's the limit on the banking industry. Yeah, Mark Carney, he's currently the head of Brookfield Management Asset Management, which is one of the biggest asset management companies in Canada. He has no political experience, although, you know, he is a good reminder of how much power the Bank of Canada has, our central bank does have, and how that was all part of the neoliberal reforms from the 1980s, very similar reforms that happened in the United States, and that handed managing the economy to the central bank, to the Bank of Canada.
In some ways, I mean, that highlights how ridiculous this is. Because actually, to go from being the central banker to the prime minister is a demotion. Like, he would actually have less power than used to enjoy.
Totally.
And certainly, like, I think at a time where, like, you know, a lot of people, their incomes are less, in part because interest rates are high, they're having to pay more for their mortgages and more for their credit card debt. I think, like, you know, like, electing someone whose main resume is he's willing to jack up interest rates to fight inflation.
Yeah.
I don't know. To me, it doesn't seem like the greatest idea. I could be wrong. Maybe the Liberal Party knows better than I do.
No, it is objectively a bad idea. There's no way this is going to work. And what's so irritating about how Canadian politics works these days is, like, we have a version of this already Freeland at least learned how to be a politician. Although I was talking about her, I was like, I'm not even sure I've ever really heard her speak French, which is a whole other issue, because you have to be able to speak French as the prime minister of this country, or else you have a really hard time with Quebec. Because, you know, for Americans, I mean, Quebec's not just a French province. It's a very French province. You know, I live in Quebec City, and there's more people here that speak Spanish that speak English as a mother tongue. Like, it's a really, 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 really French place. Carney, I don't know. He must speak French to have the job as central banker. But they tried this with Michael Ignatieff, how many election cycles ago? 4 election cycles ago, where the Liberal Party was struggling, and they're like, we need to get an internationally educated man who has, like, a stink of wealth around him, and this is going to work. It didn't work with Ignatieff. It's not going to work with Mark Carney at all. And if anything, it's going to put the leadership race for the Liberals into this really irritating arena where no one's actually talking about any real issues, because all of them are so implicated in the system as it is. So it'll be really, really difficult for those two. And then, of course, you know, there's going to be a clown parade of other candidates that may be different, may have interesting ideas. And we can, I don't know if we want to talk about any of the other front runners, but those are the two front runners. And we are setting ourselves up for a colossally boring 2 months and then a really painful election.
I mean, I think we can say of the first two front runners that I mean, they are both kind of centrist, elitist, arguably. I mean, I think in both cases, more austerity minded than Justin Trudeau was.
Yes.
Less willing to make deals with the left. I mean, I think Trudeau's accomplishments as prime ministers, you know, came from making an alliance with the NDP to stay in power. That's the Canadian Social Democratic Party, which included, like, you know, upgrading access to dental care and you know, a few other reforms that, like, have a genuine popular basis. But I mean, everything we know about Carney and Freeland, and I think Freeland, even in her letter of criticism of Trudeau, was basically, you know, we have to, like, you know, keep our eyes on the deficit.
Yeah.
So I mean, I think, like, having centrist who support austerity and who come from the very elite of society seems like a disaster, especially since, like, all the success the Conservatives are having is harvesting anti-system populist votes from people who aren't really even Conservatives, but who are, you know, like want housing, you know, and they're worried about the cost of living. But do you want to just throw in a few other names of, you know, possible leadership contenders? Is there anyone who could, like, strike a ray of hope or take the Liberal Party in, like, another direction than this path of disaster?
No, the answer is no. There is one of the jokes that I keep making is, like, there's a possibility that it's actually just going to be the 2013 Montreal mayor election redux, because Melanie Joly seems to be one person that will be running. She's currently the Minister of Foreign Affairs. And Joly, of course, entered politics by running for mayor of Montreal in 2013, losing to someone named Denis Coderre, who also is sniffing around Liberal parties looking to see if he can lead any of them again. You know, I think that, like, if we're looking at who possibly could emerge as someone that is interesting from potentially the more left side of the party, I don't want to say left wing because the party is really not that left at all. But, you know, Mark Miller has been allowed to say very honest things. Mark Miller is currently the minister of, I was going to say, Indigenous Services. He's not that minister any longer. He's Citizenship and Immigration, I think, now. And him and Trudeau are childhood friends, and he comes from Montreal. He's got the same kind of profile as Trudeau. Like, he looks, like, nice, and he's a man, and he's about the same age. He might be an interesting candidate, and he's been the one that's been saying the harshest words in reaction to Donald Trump, which is also why I'm thinking that he's a potential person to rise out of nowhere. I don't know if he would connect with, like, farmers in Manitoba necessarily, but he's been a pretty uncontroversial politician since he's been on the scene. And then people are throwing around other names like Christy Clark, which would also be a disaster. She was the former prime minister, premier of the province of British Columbia. She's also one of these people, when they speak, that you're just like, oh my God, you got to stop speaking. Very right of center, liberal.
Yeah, a right-wing liberal.
Because the Liberal Party in British Columbia really has been a conservative party. It's liberal in name only. But there are a lot of people pushing Christy Clark's name forward, which is kind of interesting. That's the real question, is who might emerge in kind of the more lateral movements than kind of moving up the chain of command in Ottawa? Is there any provincial liberals, or even, I don't know, right-leaning NDPers that would make the jump nationally to run for the National Liberal Party? It's hard to say, because it's clear that this is going to be a caretaker leadership. It's not going to be the person, this person will never be the prime minister, because they'll have too much stink of the old regime, regardless of what happens in the next election. I could be wrong. Of course, politics do swing a little bit more these days than they have in the last 20 years.
Well, but I mean, especially in Canadian politics. I mean, I think one thing worth keeping in mind is that in Canadian politics, the last, you know, 4 weeks or before an election is really when things get decided. Yeah. And one has seen in Canada, like, really wild swings of, you know, like 10, 15 percentage points, you know, like, up or down. So, I mean, there are real possibilities. One thing I may want to flag is that going back a century or more, the Liberal Party has had this tradition of alternating between English and French leaders. And that's been almost, I think, invariant. which is like an amazing thing. Yeah. So the, Justin Trudeau being, you know, French, you know, I mean, he's really bilingual or whatever, but, you know, he's with his name and his family background. He was the French, the prime minister from Quebec. So I think that within the sort of inner organs of the party, there might be some sense that, okay, now it's the turn of an Anglophone Canada.
Maybe. But the interesting thing on that, though, is if you look at Western Canada, where the Liberal Party doesn't really exist at the provincial level and has been decimated at the national level, like there really isn't. There's no like farm team that's feeding people up to the federal party, right? In Western Canada, I'm just trying to think. Chrystia Freeland fits all the boxes on that. She's a a member from Edmonton, which is of course the capital city of Alberta, and coming from that, it makes her an English Canada or Western Canada person. There might be a candidate that emerges from Atlantic Canada, but Trudeau has had such the spotlight on him in the last 9 years as prime minister. There really hasn't been much space for other people to take much profile. Freeland aside, and then of course before Freeland, Bill Morneau, his other finance minister who had to resign in scandal, and Melanie Joly, because she's the Minister of Foreign Affairs, and Canadians are realizing that Canada has no independent foreign affairs policy at all, and she's been the one saying that. So it's impossible really to know who's going to emerge because there are so few options, which means it's going to have a lot of strange possibilities come forward. But the other piece is because it's a multi-party system in a first past the post context means that the decisions and mistakes of the other parties also play a huge role in how the Liberals will do. And so, you know, talking about wild swings in the last couple of weeks of an election, that's how Justin Trudeau got elected. Right. There was an 11-week marathon campaign in 2015. Everyone was tired of Stephen Harper. He had no support whatsoever in the province of Quebec, which is very hard to win prime minister when you have no support there. And it looked like the NDP actually was going to make significant gains with the leader of Thomas Mulcair. I mean, he fumbled massively in the last 3 weeks of the campaign around budget questions. Justin Trudeau saw the moment, made it sound like he was more left-wing than the NDP, and they actually, just through the force of his promises, poof, got the majority government.
Yeah, no, and actually that 2015 moment is worth thinking about in terms of the future of the Liberal Party, because in 2015, yeah, it was partially Mulcair's fumbling, but also the Liberals had a political analysis coming from Frank Graves that basically said that the voters that were up for grab were progressive voters, and that if the Liberals could convince themselves that they were more progressive than the NDP, there are a lot of these voters that they could win over. And Mulcair handed them the perfect thing by, you know, running like as more up for austerity, more for like, you know, let's make deficit cutting the main priority. That allowed Trudeau to occupy that space. Now, it seems to me like now the Liberals are thinking, and I think this is like a huge analytical mistake on par with Kamala Harris going after the never Trump Republican vote, the Dick Cheney vote. The idea is that the people who are up for grabs are going to be these centrist voters who care about the deficit. Suddenly that these are the voters. I think that is what Freeland and Carney are indicating. But again, that opens up a lot of possibilities for the NDP to, you know, once again, distance themselves from the Liberals after working with them for years and occupying that space again. But I mean, I think that's all like in the these are all electoral questions. I think the more broader sort of existential question, I think, for Canada is like, you know, what does Trump's, you know, leadership mean? Especially when, you know, like it's not, on the one hand, you know, I think there's a good instinct to say this is all just a distraction. This is just, you know, stuff that he says to get a rise out of people. Mm-hmm. He's just trolling. But Trump has repeatedly talked in the last like 2 months about Canada being the 51st state, about Trudeau being the governor of Canada and, you know, replacing him.
Yeah.
And one sees actually, very interestingly, a kind of existential anxiety within the Canadian elite, let alone the Canadian population. The Canadian elite has been, like, you know, continentalist for a long time, has been for integrating with the U.S. That's the whole point of NAFTA, to allow Canada to be economically integrated and keep political sovereignty. And well, we see how that worked out. And so when it's seeing people like, I mentioned the Globe and Mail columnist Andrew Coyne, who is, you know, like both ideologically and I would also say biologically, the embodiment of the central Canadian Laurentian elite. You know, his father was, again, governor of Bank of Canada, and Coyne, you know, like a conservative, you know, center-right columnist, has been basically saying, like, you know, Canada needs to rethink its foreign policy. We could, with Donald Trump in power, we can no longer see him, the Americans as our most reliable ally. We need to start thinking about building coalitions with other countries. The question is, is there a possibility for a Canadian nationalist response coming out of all this? On the one hand, you know, within living memory, like within the 60s and 70s, there was a strong Canadian nationalist movement that crossed ideological lines, that included, like, you know, sort of liberals, but also some many conservatives, and that was responsible for building was responsible for building many sort of Canadian institutions. That, to my mind, that Canadian nationalism as a lived reality basically withered away after neoliberalism, after NAFTA. A lot of the sort of institutions, one could mention, say, the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, but a lot of these sort of cultural institutions that were designed to make Canada a distinct sovereign country, they kind of withered away. Yeah. The question I like maybe to put to you to put to you is, you know, is it like, since the actual institutional basis of Canadian sovereignty has withered away, has been allowed to wither away, like is there any way in which, like, you know, this national sentiment can find political form?
No, I just, you know what, this is where I have to say, well, my last book and my next book are all about this. They're all about this question. And so people should check out my books if you're really interested about Canadian stuff. It's called The Social Safety Net, which was out last summer. And the next book in the series called Canada in Decline is about the corporate control of Canada. Canada's identity, Canada's sovereignty has always been formed in opposition with the United States, to the United States. And that opposition's a funny opposition because there's always been familial lines that have gone north-south. From the earliest days of the colonies, there's always been trade that's been north-south. You know, like the cradle of Canadian industrialization was the Lachine Canal, and it was deeply integrated to American canals and waterways. We've had joint management over really critical infrastructure like waterways for years. There were rail connections. Like, the country's, like, to be a Canadian is to live in opposition to the United States, whereas to be an American is to, like, not even think that Canada exists at all. It doesn't matter, right? We are deeply aware. We're so aware of the presence of the United States that from the very beginning of Canada, our leaders, our governments, created economic policies that tried to break or interrupt the North-South trading relationship and create an east-west trading relationship. At its core, that was why we built the National Railway, because we needed to settle Western Canada with white people, had to clear out Indigenous nations that had always lived there, and create a north-south movement of people and goods within this country, an east-west movement of people and goods in this country, because otherwise there was no reason we wouldn't be part of the United States. And American leaders have always mused about invading Canada. You know, Roosevelt in the late 1890s was like, oh, where should we invade? And his little cabal of people were like, let's invade Canada. And that lasted for maybe a couple of months where they were like, is this possible? And then no, finally they settled on the Spanish colonies. Like, that would be more, that would bring us more, you know, action, which it totally did, because invading Canada is silly and it's been tried, right? We know that we should know our history here. And so there's always been, and it's mostly come from the Tories, from the right side of the political spectrum, that we have to build a Canadian nationalism, a Canadian sovereignty. And that is why so many of these institutions were created by conservatives, understanding that you can't have sovereignty if you don't have some sort of telecommunications network. You can't have sovereignty if you don't have your own publicly controlled airlines. And again, even that was done in opposition to the United States, because the United States didn't have the same experience as publicly owned things, because it didn't need the same experience of publicly owned things, because there was no threat of Canada and Mexico taking over the United States. It was always vice versa. So, you know, this is Canada for 100 years, 110 years. And then all of a sudden, neoliberalism comes along and obliterates everything about the system that allowed Canadians to protect itself, to develop its own, our own culture, to develop our own literature and our own movies and our own language and way of speaking English. And of course, Quebec has its own way of speaking French. And neoliberalism says none of that is worth it because it's all expensive. It's all state funded. You can't make money off of this. Your TV shows suck. Your music is irritating. Canadian artists can go to the United States and become famous, and we'll get the music back, or we'll have to watch Saturday Night Live and be told it's funny, even though we all have aunts and uncles who are way funnier than anything that's ever been on Saturday Night Live. And Canadians themselves forgot that there was an actual program, an intensive project to create sovereignty in this country, because we never talked about it. Mm-hmm. And so for the neoliberal period, the last 30 years, that intentionality was gone. It was swept away by the economic policies of neoliberalism. And here we are today. And it's like, well, why wouldn't we join the United States?
Yeah, no,
I actually like, what's stopping? Like, you know, like, we could call it trolling, but what Donald Trump is doing, he's not trolling. He knows that there's anxiety here, and he's saying what's kind of honest, and that's what's freaking Canadians out, going, oh, no, but we're different. It's like, we were different, and you eggheads were the ones that were like, you know what? Let's get rid of all of this. We'll consume all American culture. We'll consume all American sports. We'll consume all American goods. We'll deeply integrate ourselves to the American market. And then the second that you get a guy who's like, oh, I'm just joking, you go, oh, darn, were we supposed to like have identity anymore? Like, as you say, healthcare was part of our identity, which is kind of silly.
Yeah.
Like, to have a public program be part of our identity, it should just be but people are very, 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 healthcare is important. In the last 24 hours, two people have died in emergency rooms in this country. One was a four-year-old because they couldn't see a doctor on time. Like, there's everything about what made us Canadian has been under assault by the very same people that are trying to run in politics and tell us that they're going to improve these things. And that creates a cognitive dissonance that is an existential threat for these parties. Because even Poilievre is not going to be able to sustain this line very long. It's going to run very, very thin very quickly the second he's in power. And Canadians will still go around looking, going, what's the problem? What's the problem? What happened? Because they don't let us tell these stories anymore either. Like, you know, no one wants to listen to me talk about any of this stuff in this country. No one else is saying these things because we're all shut out of being able to talk about it. So we get Andrew Coyne being like, oh, you know, all we have to do is neoliberalism, but harder this time. It's like, shut up.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is the case. I think that the Canadian elite, I mean, they do have this anxiety about the loss of sovereignty, but they themselves, I mean, they're the cause of their own problem. So it is like, it's like that meme, Spider-Man pointing at Spider-Man. I mean, it is absolutely the case that within, and I think this actually is maybe the deeper cause of Trudeau's demise, that is very striking that, like, you know, when Trump started talking about Canada as a 51st state, you know, Trudeau went down to Mar-a-Lago and tried to talk nice. And and I think that any other Canadian leader, Poilievre, is probably going to end up doing the same thing.
Totally.
Whereas conversely, one can see, you know, in another country that is also economically tied to the United States through NAFTA, Mexico, you know, the response has been totally different. The president of Mexico, Sheinbaum, has like been very, you know, she basically, in response to Trump's trolling, took out a map and, you know, said, you know, well, you know, California and Texas, they all used to be part of Mexico. So, I mean, like, you know, within Mexico, they're as integrated as they are into the North American economy. I mean, they are resources of national distinction, partially based on like economic policy, actually, like, like, you know,
under, and they have culture.
They have a you know, a genuine cultural difference. But also, I mean, I think strikingly, like, it is not a neoliberal government in Mexico, and it is actually a government that has tried to stake out, you know, like, actual policy differences within capitalism, of like actually you know, trying to ameliorate the lot of ordinary people. So I mean, yeah, I think that the sort of Canadian dilemma is like, you know, like, you know, neoliberalism has destroyed the basis of its own support in a lot of ways, and then so we're sort of like walking on thin air right now.
Like,
and Wile E. Coyote, like, just off
we're standing
that edge,
there, just waiting,
standing there,
to discover gravity. And thank God we haven't discovered gravity yet. You know, it's funny because like all of these cultural critics from the 1960s, the conservative cultural critics in Canada knew this was coming. Knew, like, argued like this: the liberals are going towards an internationalism that will threaten our sovereignty. And the left, the way that the left dealt with this was to argue for sovereignty from American institutions on the left. So sovereignty from the auto workers and from other large unions, and making sure that we actually had Canadian unions, right? That spirit is gone. And the problem, of course, is that it's been replaced by a nativism that is racist and xenophobic, and is fueled by the fact that McKinsey's the company we hired to figure out our immigration quotas, and then we outsourced it to the literal worst humans in the country, the leadership of colleges. So the senior administrators of colleges who were then the ones to say, okay, we'll run Canada's immigration system. So it's problem upon problem. And the real crisis in Canada is no one with a national platform, no one in any of the national parties is has the capacity to deal with any of this stuff, maybe with the exception of the Bloc. But again, the Bloc's interest is pretty limited.
To
go back to it, right? The Bloc might give Canada a fighting chance at having foreign policy again, because this is a party that is full of people that have been internationally educated, that look at different parts of the world than the rest of Canada, which just looks at the United States. That's a small piece of hope. But I mean, the leader is barely coherent in English, so it's not going to go very far.
Yeah, no. Well, on that sort of dire note, but I think accurate note, I want to thank Nora for being on the program, and I'm sure we'll be back in the future to talk about this strange land to the north of the United States called Canada.
Yeah, I'll let you know if we ended up falling, found that gravity and collapsed out of the air.
Oh, I think it's going to happen very soon, yes.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.